Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1146. The Space Plane COVID-19 and the Paperclip Legacy Part 1. This is being recorded on August 25th of the year 2020. The title of this show is in some ways somewhat misleading. The Paperclip Legacy is a reference to Project Paperclip, which was the importation of the cream of Third Reich scientists into the U.S. to work for our national security establishment. Probably the best known of those was SS officer Werner von Braun, the head of America's space program. We'll be talking about him at some length. There were many others as well, including, as we will see in some of our next programs, Josef Mengele, the angel of death of Auschwitz. There has been no official record of him working for the U.S., but we are going to go back to the winter of 1986 in subsequent programs, and we're going to take a look at an article by Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley researcher, called How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other. This from Covert Action Quarterly number 25 in the winter of 1986, and the evidence does indeed point to Mengele having gone to work for the U.S., and certainly he is networking with other Nazi and SS war criminals who certainly were working with Alan Dulles and ultimately became part of the Gehlen Org and the CIA. This program will be talking about things that occurred in the past, but it also is something that reflects directly on things that are going on today. It will also involve some admittedly speculative elements. As I am speaking on August 25th of the year 2020, the Republican Convention is underway in North Carolina, and Northern California is burning. Something that we have spoken about at some length in many shows, and I will have some links to those programs in the written description for this broadcast, and that is Project HARP. That is a national security operation in which electromagnetic radiation was used for environmental modification, not only modifying the weather, but in all probability helping to stimulate other natural phenomena such as earthquakes. It is based on Tesla technology, the technology developed by the genius Nikola Tesla in the last century. And although many of the things that are discussed in those programs, and in particular with our interviews with Nick Begich, the author of Angels Don't Play This Harp, in fact, those things are a matter of public record, although it will be dismissed by those who continue to view important national security developments, and in particular anything having to do with the intelligence community, as conspiracy theory and dismiss it as such. You know, that's conspiracy theory. Make sure you don't get any on your shoes. In fact, the U.S. and former Soviet Union had a treaty on environmental modification and the use of weather, among other things, as a weapon of war in the 1970s. That was a long time ago. Project HARP went online a full quarter of a century ago. It also allegedly went offline as well. The news, the CBS AM news radio station, KCBS here in the Bay Area, had a blurb early in the year about a space plane. This is a highly secretive X-37B aircraft that can stay aloft for vast lengths of time. It is on the cutting edge of military technology, and its missions have been, as one might expect, classified in nature. In other words, we the public who finance the military and the national security establishment basically have no substantive knowledge about what this aspect of it is doing. I heard this report on KCBS, and it was announced that the actual results of the actual nature of the mission was classified, but that the mission was viewed by the Pentagon as a success. At that time, Northern California, which normally has a lot of rainfall in February, began an enormous drought, or a severe drought. For the first time since they began keeping records, Northern California had no rainfall whatsoever in February of 2020. This was a very unfortunate and ominous development, and it portended a horrendous fire season here in California, which we are now having. It is going to strain the California budget, which had been cited by people like Paul Krugman of the New York Times as an example of how an economy can be successfully managed without tax cuts and without worrying too much about the budget. Now the California economy, between COVID-19 and these blazing fires that are the result of a drought, again, for the first time since they began keeping records, the month of February saw no rainfall whatsoever. And this was right about the time that the space plane concluded the mission of some year and a half, as I recall. And again, the nature of it was classified. I have been wondering about the possibility of improved weather and environmental modification technology for military purposes, on top of and beyond what Project HARP entailed. Again, Project HARP went online in 1995. The Wright brothers, for example, flew in 1903. By the late 1920s, aircraft carriers, relatively sophisticated bomber aircraft were involved. And so, military technology can evolve tremendously in 25 years. Again, the former Soviet Union and the U.S. have a treaty on environmental modification for military purposes on the books by the mid-1970s. That was some 45 years ago, 45 years after the Wright brothers flew in 1903. The first jet bombers were in an advanced state of R&D. The A-bomb was a reality, and the H-bomb was about to become one. Guided missiles were being developed. So knowing that environmental modification for military purposes was underway, was basically considered a reality by the 70s, should inform us that at this point in time it will be way beyond that. That this highly secret space plane may have been involved in something like that is obviously a matter of speculation. However, I'm wondering about climate alteration as a weapon. I wonder about the fires that are making life hell for people here in Northern California, as well as for Governor Newsom and the twin plagues, so to speak, of COVID-19, which have made it much more difficult to have prison firefighters combating these multiple blazes, and the very, frankly to me, suspicious, complete absence of rainfall in the month of February, which normally is our rainiest month here in Northern California, have hoped to spur this particular point of inquiry. We're going to be doing a number of different programs in this series, and we will be talking not only about Project Paperclip, but about things that took place during World War II. We'll be talking about those now. That set the stage for much of what has happened since. We will be talking about arrangements that were made during World War II in which basically the U.S. Was realigned as part of the Axis. Perhaps the best manifestation of that, or the best known manifestation of that, is the Trilateral Commission, those three sides being the U.S., Japan, and Germany, with the importation of the Bormann, not the importation, but with the fusing of the Bormann Network, the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization that I believe will prove to be the decisive element in human history, with the wealth that was looted from occupied Asia by Japan in World War II, the incorporation of the Galen spy outfit, and the importation of the paperclip scientists. Basically, the U.S. was realigned during the latter stages of World War II with the Axis. That may seem crazy to some people, but we will be talking about that, and we will be looking at the Republican Party. Again, as I'm speaking, on August 25th of 2020, the Republicans are having their convention, and we will be taking a look at how the Republican Party is basically an extension of the Third Reich in many ways, and we will be taking a good look at William Casey as well. In our three programs about the Uyghurs and the destabilization of China, 1143, 44, and 45, I noted that many of the intelligence fronts involved with the Uyghurs and with other aspects of the destabilization of China were formed by William Casey or under his watch as CIA director. William Casey is a very, very important figure, and we will be winding up this series before we return back to the COVID-19 phenomenon with William Casey. I guess you could say we will be taking a look at Casey at the bat. As I wonder about the stunning drought that we have here in California, which has led to the northern part of this state basically burning and a horrendous air quality, so too there have been some devastating weather phenomenon in China, in China as well. Again, I am asking the musical question, might some of these things, not only the Northern California drought and the fires, but also the floods affecting China, might some of these be a manifestation of environmental warfare, and what relationship might they have to the space plane? We will be talking about that in just a minute. Of the flooding of China, I had been expecting, and I've spoken about COVID-19 in connection with the full court press against China and the array of covert operations against China for many weeks. And indeed, the COVID-19 phenomenon has much more to do, has to do with much more than just China. We'll talk about that in weeks to come. The notion, by the way, as the Republicans are having their convention, the notion that Trump mishandled the COVID-19 pandemic is pure BS. He handled it exactly the way it was supposed to be handled. It is a wealth concentration virus. It is serving to concentrate wealth as never before. It is the education destruction virus. It is hammering state government. It's hammering not only public education, but college education, state and local government. It is hammering public transportation, communities of color, and poor people, and the rich are getting richer. All of those things are part and parcel to the Republican agenda. So we'll talk about that and some of the various phenomenon or the various manifestations of the bio-psyop apocalypse, as I have called it. We'll be coming back to that concept in weeks to come. And by the way, the COVID-19 pandemic is destabilizing individuals and communities in a big way. Substance addiction is up. Depression is up. People are gaining weight. Domestic violence is up. And I think a lot of the violent and vicious behavior we have been seeing is being exacerbated by the pandemic. But that, again, in weeks to come. China, I was expecting environmental HAARP-type efforts against China, and China is indeed experiencing some record flooding or near-record flooding. Obviously, climate change is a reality. I wonder if that is what is involved here. I also wonder if we are looking at HAARP type technology. In that context, from the New York Times of August 22nd of 2020, after virus, new hurdles for China from flooding. This by Stephen Lee Myers. It reads in part, having brought the coronavirus pandemic largely under control, China's leaders are now struggling with a surge of crippling floods that have killed hundreds of people and displaced millions across the central and southwestern parts of the country. And speaking of China's leader, Mr. Li visited Chongqing, where the Yangtze spilled over its banks for the fifth time this year, and on Thursday afternoon breached the historical high reached in 1981. The leaders have tried to reassure people that the government was doing everything it could, but some might have doubts. And this next statement is one of the reasons I ask the musical question, might China be being subjected to environmental warfare, HAARP-type warfare? And in fact, is the highly secret space plane involved in some of these things? Continuing, quote, I believe that the Chinese public will question Beijing from this year's continuous natural and man-made disasters, and even question China's governance model and its effectiveness, unquote, said Wu Qiang, Q-I-A-N-G, an independent political analyst in Beijing. Well, again, I wonder about the same thing. And with California being the largest and most influential blue state, and a state that at this point is fire orange with gray skies because California is burning, I think it is reasonable to ask if perhaps environmental warfare is being used in China, perhaps here in the U.S. as well, as part of something of an informal pas de deux along with COVID-19. Now, again, we don't know precisely what the space plane has been doing. It is a remarkable technology. It can apparently stay aloft for a year or more at a time, and it is involved in some highly classified projects. And one of the people involved in this is a fellow named William Brown from Raytheon, and he went to work with NASA's Wernher von Braun, the SS officer and a Nazi war criminal who headed up America's space program. I've spoken about him at great length in the past. From the Defense One publication of May 6th of 2020, this by Patrick Tucker, T-U-C-K-E-R, the Air Force's secret space plane is part of a plan to one day shoot microwaves to Earth. And if that is in fact the case, or if that's a cover, is a matter of speculation. The article reads in part, little is known about the X-37B space plane and what exactly it's been doing during missions that now total nearly 8 years in orbit. On Wednesday, the U.S. Air Force revealed some of the satellite payloads and experiments it will carry aloft this month, including one that will try converting the sun's energy into a form that can be sent to Earth. Skipping down. In the 1960s, Raytheon's William Brown went to work with NASA's Wernher von Braun on converting microwave beams into electrical current. The concept had particular relevance for powering future spacecraft, but also promised a way to harness the power of sunlight up to 10 times more potent above the atmosphere and its dust for use on Earth. Skipping down again. Of course, microwaves from space could also potentially be a weapon. The Defense Department has floated the idea of space-based microwaves to fry the electronics of missiles taking off from launch pads. But Brian Weeden, W-E-E-D-E-N, technical advisor for the Secure World Foundation, said that limited power levels should suggest the current experiments weren't about that, which may very well be the case. Does this perhaps involve HAARP-type environmental modification / weather control? Skipping down again. About the extreme operational secrecy of the X-37B space plane. On the previous mission, they deployed three small satellites from the X-37B and didn't even catalog them until after it had landed and those satellites had decayed from orbit, unquote, he said. That's the sort of non-transparent and potentially irresponsible behavior the U.S. has criticized the Russians and Chinese for in the past, unquote. And again, we are left basically having to speculate about these missions because they are classified. We are not being told what is going on. We do know, again, that environmental modification for military purposes was the focal point of a treaty between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union the better part of a half century ago, and that is a long time in terms of the development of military R&D. Now, Wernher von Braun, of course, it was not only an officer in the SS, anything but the apolitical technocrat he has been represented as being. I remember as a little kid seeing Wernher von Braun on Walt Disney's show and kind of scratching my head at what this was all about. He has been portrayed as a really great guy and an apolitical technocrat. In fact, as we looked at in For the Record 874, among other programs, he was not only a member of the SS, but he was a war criminal. He was deeply involved with the slave labor at Peenemünde, Nordhausen, during World War II. We're not going to have time in this program. I'm going to put some of the documentation of that. Again, we talked about that in among other shows for the record 874, and I will have some of that information in the written description for this and other programs. What we're going to do, again, to look at how the present has evolved from the past, and although we are going back once again to World War II, we are going to be taking a look at the evolution of events during World War II right on up through the present and the evolution of the Republican Party in connection with these phenomena. There is a very important book that was published by a right-wing publisher and a right-wing author. It's called The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. It is tri-authored by Dean Reuter, R-E-U-T-E-R, or maybe Reuter, I've never heard it pronounced, Colm Lowry, and Keith Chester. It was published in hardcover by Regnery History and copyrighted 2019. Dean Reuter, or Reuter, is the head of the Federalist Society, a right-wing judicial organization, and the book has a very obvious conservative / right-wing bias. Nonetheless, it is a very important book, and the hidden Nazi, the titular figure in this book, is an SS general named Hans HANS Kammler, K-A-M-M-L-E-R, officially reported to have committed suicide. He was, in fact, a very, very important figure, not only involved with setting up the concentration camps and Auschwitz, but he was involved with various secret Nazi weapons development programs and was the handler for people like Walter Dornberger, the military commander of Peenemünde Nordhausen, and people like Werner von Braun. Again, officially, Hans Kammler, quote, committed suicide, unquote, but in fact, the available evidence suggests very strongly that he was involved with making a deal with the U.S. In fact, the U.S. made a deal with the devil, in this case, Hans Kammler. The authors, or at least Mr. Reuter, or Reuter, who wrote this, are very conservative. However, it is clear, despite the fact, for example, that they referred to Alan Dulles as a patriotic American and felt that his dealings with people like Kammler in all probability were necessary to assure America's primacy in the Cold War, etc. It is clear from reading the book that at least by the end of the book, the authors had some doubts about some of this and were beginning to, I think, perhaps look over their shoulder and say, maybe this had some negative implications for America. Most of it is, again, very conservative, and they speak highly of Alan Dulles. At least Dean Reuter, or Reuter, speaks highly of Alan Dulles. However, in this book, there is a very important section which talks about Project Hermes. That was the General Electric / American V-2 rocket project that was officially contracted for by GE on November 20th of 1944. By December of 1944, 6 months before the end of World War II, the aforementioned Walter Dornberger, the military commander of the V-2 and rocket programs, and Werner von Braun were in touch with GE, apparently through Hans Kammler, or with the, under the agency, I should say, of Hans Kammler, and in all probability, Alan Dulles as well. And they were being maneuvered into the position of heading up GE's Project Hermes and the American, quote, V2, unquote, project. Again, this is in late 1944. There is informed speculation in this book that one of the agents involved with helping to arrange this deal between Walter Dornberger and Werner von Braun and General Electric, again, under the agency of SS General Hans Kammler, was Sigismund, S-I-G-I-S-M-U-N-D, von Braun. He was Werner von Braun's brother. He was part of the Third Reich's diplomatic contingent at the Vatican, and he was also apparently an agent for the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, which was the SS Intelligence Service, as we have seen and as we will get to either in this program or our next by way of review. Alan Dulles, in 1943, was conducting negotiations through Prince Egon Max von Hohenlohe of the Habsburg family, acting as an agent for Walter Schellenberg, who was in charge of foreign intelligence for the SG, which was the SS Intelligence Service, and they were working out negotiations as the war was underway, and in Dulles' case, of working in an altogether treasonous fashion. But the authors here engaged in informed speculation that Sigismund von Braun, again, an apparent SG agent and the brother of Werner von Braun, may very well have been one of the people who was involved in setting up this deal, again, in late 1944, between General Electric and Walter Dornberger and Wernher von Braun. Again, the Kammler, you will hear about, again, Hans, H-A-N-S, Kammler, K-A-M-M-L-E-R. He did not, in fact, commit suicide, and he is one of the most important figures in the Third Reich and a very sinister individual as well. Of this apparent deal between Dornberger and von Braun, apparently under the agency of Hans Kammler, and apparent SG agent Sigismund von Braun, the brother of Wernher von Braun. Again, this before the end of 1944. We read again from the book, The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil by Dean Reuter, Colm Lowry, and Keith Chester. Secretly recorded post-war conversations with Walter Dornberger, the military administrative head of the Germans' rocket project, confirmed that, as the Battle of the Bulge was being waged and lost, he and rocket scientist Wernher von Braun agreed that the larger war was itself lost. Therefore, they got in touch with the U.S. government and a prominent U.S. business through the German embassy in Lisbon to broker a deal. Quote, according to Dornberger, unquote, Colm said, again quoting, he and Wernher von Braun made contact as early as December of 1944. Dornberger and von Braun were in touch with GE, General Electric, the American company. Again, quoting, we have no conclusive information as to how Dornberger and von Braun reached out to GE, but we're certain that they did. We don't know whether it was in person or not, or whether the contact had been initiated the other way around. It is not clear whether von Braun and Dornberger traveled to Lisbon or communicated by telex, diplomatic pouch, or even through an intermediary. But this has General Hans Kammler's fingerprints all over it, Colm assured me. Here's the whole quote. Dornberger, in conversation with General Major Bassange, made the following miscellaneous remarks dealing with those two. He said that, quote, Braun and Dornberger himself had realized at the end of December of 1944 that things were going wrong and had consequently been in touch since that time, again, December of 1944, with the General Electric Company through the German Embassy in Portugal with a view to coming to some arrangement. By the way, we should perhaps mention before we continue with the text here, it is relatively well known that Spain, although officially neutral, was a fascist country under Francisco Franco and collaborated with the Third Reich. The same was true of Portugal as well. Although nominally neutral, in fact, under Enrique Salazar, Portugal was a fascist dictatorship as well. And that is where, in Lisbon, is where this took place. Continuing with the account of the Kammler, Sigismund von Braun, Dornberger, Wernher von Braun liaison with GE. The exact timing, mode of contact, or even whether there had been intermediaries could not be determined from this language. We couldn't even tell which side initiated the contact, only that Dornberger and von Braun had, quote, been in touch, unquote, with GE to come to some arrangement, unquote. I flashed on the memory of Jörg Kammler, Hans Kammler's son, telling me that his mother had always insisted that Kammler never approached the Americans to make a deal, but that they had approached him to make a deal. Either way, I thought, this news was huge. Colm, by the way, that's C-O-L-M, quickly gave me his analysis of the new information in light of our other known facts. He was certain Colmer would not have let Von Braun out of the country, and I agreed, so if in-person contact had been made in Lisbon, it would have been through Dornberger. Colm said it was possible that Dornberger made the trip to Lisbon with Sigismund von Braun, Werner's brother. Quote, Sigismund was a German diplomat with great influence and a Nazi. After the war, he would become West Germany's Secretary of State, living to a ripe old age until 1998. During the war, he was a German representative to the Vatican. The Vatican, Colm continued, was instrumental in other negotiations at the end of the war, and Sigismund is also known to have participated in other talks, so he might well have been involved here. He would certainly have had interest in beginning again. He would certainly have had an interest in helping his brother, and Werner would have preferred having his own brother, his own flesh and blood, and not just Dornberger at the table on his behalf, unquote. That made sense to me, but there was even more to this thread. What has seemingly never been discussed is Sigismund von Braun's role as an apparent Sicherheitsdienst agent within the Vatican, as indicated by a January 1945 document that Colm had uncovered by the acting director of the Washington, D.C. office of the OSS, the precursor organization to the CIA. The SD, or Sicherheitsdienst, headed first by Holocaust mastermind Reinhard Heydrich, was the intelligence arm of the Nazi Party, charged with rooting out enemies of the party, both externally and from within the ranks. Frankly, I wasn't sure if Sigismund, as an agent of the SD, would have been more or less likely to have facilitated the Lisbon contract, though these connections never ceased to amaze me. Again, interrupting briefly, the SD was the SS intelligence service. Continuing. We also have wartime intelligence records that connect Sigismund von Braun with Baron Ernst von Weizsäcker, the German ambassador to the Holy See and the father of noted German nuclear physicist Carl Friedrich Freiherr von Weizsäcker in November of 1944. It would also have made sense for Dornberger to choose von Weizsäcker as a travel companion because von Weizsäcker's diplomatic status and likely frequent trips would have meant he could have made the trip to Lisbon without raising an eyebrow. We can also tie von Weizsäcker's son's nuclear research to Kammler and von Braun as well. And again, Hans Kammler was in charge of highly secret Third Reich military development programs and R&D programs that were, in fact, far in advance of what the public has been told. Continuing, moreover, the senior Weizsäcker was one of the perceived neutrals authorized by Hitler's foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop, who himself had been authorized by Hitler to make peace overtures to the Western Allies. In the end, I decided it didn't really matter whether Dornberger went to Lisbon himself, with a fellow traveler, or at all. What was plain from this new record was that both Dornberger and von Braun were in contact with General Electric. Quote, all good, but why meet with GE? I asked Colm, still confused. I knew GE was big today, but I didn't know much about its history. Colm told me GE was a contractor. Contractor for who? For what? Still befuddled, not quite following. For the U.S. government, for Project Hermes, Colm said, pausing for my response. I could tell from the note of finality that this was supposed to mean something to me. Project Hermes? That rang a faint bell, though at the moment my head was not in World War II, but in my work world, where Hermes was an expensive necktie, not some military op. I couldn't place it. Project Hermes was the GE project to develop a U.S. version of the V-2 rocket, Cone prompted. What the hell, I said too loudly, turning the heads of a few colleagues. That is unbelievable. What did this mean? The contract putting GE in charge of the American V-2 project was let on November 20th, 1944, Cone told me. And before the ink was dry, GE was in contact with Dornberger and von Braun, Kammler's underlings and proteges. That was astounding. I noted that GE would never have contacted the Nazi rocket team without explicit authorization from the contractor, the U.S. government. So the contact must have been sanctioned at the highest levels of the American government. On the German side, Kammler had to have been involved. Von Braun and Dornberger had no authority or ability to manipulate events as the war wound down, but Kammler did. They, meaning the Dornberger and von Braun, could not order the cream of the German rocket team to evacuate Peenemünde for Nordhausen and then evacuate Nordhausen for Oberammergau, ultimately to the waiting U.S. Army, but Hans Kammler could and did. Von Braun himself told us it was Kammler who ordered the Peenemünde evacuation. Von Braun and Dornberger could not ensure that Hitler's orders to destroy the rocket facilities were ignored, and they could not disobey Hitler's orders to annihilate the entire German rocket team, specifically to prevent them from falling into the hands of Germany's enemies. But as we shall see, Hans Kammler could and did, and the venture was successful and was made. Werner von Braun would become the leader of this key GE project, whose in-house director was Richard W. Porter, P-O-R-T-E-R. GE was so hungry to collect the Nazi rocket resources that at the end of the war, Porter was flown to Europe to handpick German scientists and engineers most capable of helping. Porter would also helpfully identify essential rocket parts for shipment back to the U.S., all to the benefit of the U.S. and, of course, GE, his employer. Indeed, a post-war report by the U.S. Air Force claiming that using German scientists meant a savings of 40% to 50% on the overall Hermes. Indeed, a post-war report by the U.S. Air Force claimed that using German scientists meant a savings of 40% to 50% on the overall Hermes contract. GE was able to pick up where the Nazi project had left off, rather than reinventing the wheel, literally reinventing the rocket. The timing of these seemingly unrelated events is the key to understanding them. The Hermes GE contract was inked in November of 1944. In January of 1945, von Braun held a, quote, secret meeting, unquote, in Peenemünde with colleagues, including Dornberger's chief of staff, to discuss the, quote, eventual feasibility of surrendering the development team intact, unquote. The Kammler order to evacuate Peenemünde would come on January 31st of 1945. Thereafter, Kammler would move the rocket scientists into the waiting arms of the Americans in Oberammergau. The tightly sequenced events tell a clear story. Kammler, as behind a deal for U.S. forces to capture the Nazis' rocket program, and give a new home to the Nazi rocket scientists and perhaps to their boss, Hans Kammler, himself. Kammler would preserve the rocket team, turn them over to the Americans, and in return, hopefully, save his own life. And later on in the book, they speculate, I would say, in all probability accurately, that the main point of contact, the liaison between the Dornberger, von Braun, Kammler, Sigismund von Braun nexus was Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell. Returning again to The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil by Dean Reuter, Colm Lowry, and Keith Chester. In the interwar years, this is, by the way, between the two world wars, in the interwar years, American businesses and banks invested heavily in the German economy. As collateral, American investors often took back shares of stock in Swiss holding companies that themselves owned German bank stocks. Numerous U.S. companies have German sister companies or subsidiaries and vice versa, with interlocking boards of directors. It was the beginning of the era of global companies, or at least international businesses. One such company was General Electric, which had a German counterpart, AEG, which did manufacture V2 electronics. The two businesses produced many of the same goods and shared some board members and investors. And GE was a client of Dulles's firm. If, in his position in the OSS, Alan Dulles made a deal with Hans Kammler and could offer up the German rocket industry to GE, lock, stock, and barrel, he would be saving one of his firm's clients a decade of work and perhaps untold sums of money. I would note that as we get into that aforementioned article by Peter Dale Scott, how Alan Dulles and the SS preserved each other, again, from this is about 35 years ago, from Covert Action Quarterly, we will take a look at how the Vatican and Alan Dulles and the SS were all working together. In Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam of the Swastika, recapped, by the way, in For the Record 511, we took a look at the fact that AEG, German General Electric, was 30% owned by American GE. And we should note here again that AEG did manufacture electronics for the V2. One of the things about Alan Dulles and later his... Well, with Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, both of whom worked for Sullivan and Cromwell and who were instrumental in helping to build the Third Reich and incorporating the Galen Organization, the Bormann Group, the paperclip scientists, and in John Foster Dulles' case, helping to meld the Golden Lily loot into the post-war, global economy. Those two men, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, as counsels for Sullivan and Cromwell, were at the very epicenter of American corporate maneuvering. And it might be worth reviewing some of that. We're going to review a passage we have used before to give people an idea of what made Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles so important, and why, when these two men, both of whom were collaborators in a big way with the Third Reich, and in John Foster Dulles' case, with Imperial Japan as well, because these men, who then went on to become Secretary of State in John Foster Dulles' case, and head of the CIA in Alan Dulles' case under Dwight Eisenhower, these two men at Sullivan and Cromwell were at the very epicenter of American corporate power. Of Sullivan and Cromwell, we read. And by the way, Edison General Electric became General Electric. And again, AEG German General Electric, which had an interlocking directorate with GE, was 30% owned by GE, manufactured electronics for the V2. From a book called The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War by Stephen Kinzer, published in softcover by St. Martin, and copyright 2013, we read. In 1882, Sullivan and Cromwell created Edison General Electric. Again, that became GE. 7 years later, with the financier J.P. Morgan as its client, it wove 21 steelmakers into the National Tube Company, and then, in 1891, merged National Tube with 7 other companies to create U.S. Steel, capitalized at more than $1 billion, an astounding sum at the time. The railroad magnate E.H. Harriman, whom President Theodore Roosevelt had denounced as a, quote, malefactor of great wealth, unquote, and, quote, an enemy of the Republic, unquote, hired Sullivan and Cromwell to wage 2 of his legendary proxy wars, one to take over the Illinois Central Railroad and another to fend off angry shareholders at Wells Fargo Bank. It won the first with tactics that the New York newspaper called, quote, one of those ruthless exercises of the power of sheer millions, unquote, and the second with complex maneuvers that, according to a book about the firm, amounted to, quote, deceit, bribery, and trickery that was all legal, unquote. Soon afterward, working on behalf of French investors who were facing ruin after their effort to build up a canal across Panama collapsed, Sullivan and Cromwell achieved a unique triumph in global politics. Through a masterful lobbying campaign, its endlessly resourceful managing partner William Nelson Cromwell persuaded the U.S. Congress to reverse its decision to build a canal across Nicaragua and to pay his French clients $40 million for their land in Panama instead. Then he helped engineer a revolution that pulled the province of Panama away from the nation of Colombia and established it as an independent country led by a clique willing to show its gratitude by allowing construction of a canal on terms favorable to the United States. One newspaper called him, quote, the man whose masterful mind whetted on the grindstone of corporate cunning conceived and carried out the rape of the isthmus. So again, when we talk about John Foster Dulles, as we did in, for the record, 1142, we've spoken about him in many other shows as well. When we talk about Alan Dulles, this is the focal point of their power. And bear in mind that Alan Dulles, during World War II, was not only head of the Bern, Switzerland OSS office, but was in touch with Prince Max Eggen von Hohenlohe, acting as an intermediary for Walter Schellenberg. Walter Schellenberg was the head of foreign intelligence for the aforementioned SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS Intelligence Service. He also, by the way, was a member of the board of directors of IT&T. Of what Alan Dulles was doing at that time, and this is why his probable role as the lead American contact to establish the liaison between Dornberger and Wernher von Braun and GE and Project Hermes, again in late 1944, makes all the sense in the world. We're going to conclude with a review of a passage from the book American Swastika by Charles Higham, published in hardcover by Doubleday and Company, copyright 1985. And this is Alan Dulles and also William Donovan of the OSS. Again, in 1943, with negotiations with representatives of the Nazi SS. This basically is treason of these negotiations. Dulles pressed ahead. He said that it would be unbearable for any decent European to think that the Jews might return to Europe someday, and that there must be no toleration of a return of the Jewish power positions. He reiterated his desire for a greater European political federation and foresaw the federal Germany that in fact took place. He made the curious assertion that the Americans were only continuing the war to get rid of the Jews, and that there were people in America who were intending to send the Jews to Africa. This was Hitler's dream, of course, that the Jews would go to Madagascar and stay there. Dulles now proceeded to supply von Hohenlohe with dollops of secret intelligence, something announcing that the U.S. Army would not land in Spain, but after conquering Tunisia, would advance from Africa toward the Palestri oil fields to cut off the German oil supplies. He said it was unlikely that the Allies would land in Sicily to cut off Rommel and control Italy from there, and thus secure, he said that it was likely that the Allies would land in Sicily to cut off Rommel and control Italy from there, and thus secured the advance in the Balkans. Having given virtually the entire battle plan for Europe, top secret at the time, to one of Germany's agents, Alan Dulles proceeded to the almost unnecessary rider that he had very good relations with the Vatican. In other meetings, Dulles predicted, quote, that the next world war would be between the USA and the Soviet Union, unquote. Dulles obtained a great deal of information relating to Germany and plans for its reconstruction after the war. He described a recent speech by Joseph Goebbels as, quote, a work of genius. I have rarely read a speech with such rational pleasure, unquote. In July, OSS Chief William Donovan and the OSS began to take matters into their own hands. No doubt inspired by the invigorating meeting in Switzerland, Donovan embarked on the so-called M Project. By now, the German Franz von Papen had read the details of a peace proposal on microfilm and learned that it was more or less on the same lines as the Dulles proposals. Germany would be set up as the dominating force in industry and agriculture in continental Europe, at the heart of a continental state run by Germany, the USA, and Great Britain as a focus of trade. And as we can see, basically, and this in 1943, not only was Alan Dulles revealing the Allies' plans to the enemy, he also was basically discussing what in fact took place, the development of the post-World War II world. We will be going into Alan Dulles, the Vatican, and other negotiations in this series, and we will see how these events ultimately dovetail with the Republican Party, which, as I am speaking on August 25th of the year 2020, is having its convention in North Carolina. And we will, in particular, take a look at how the Vatican hooked up with us, and we will take a look at William Casey and wind up with the Republican Party as an extension of the Third Reich. This concludes For the Record program number 1146, The Space Plane, COVID-19, and the Paperclip Legacy Part 1. This is being recorded on August 25th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.